evening. Tonight, our speaker is Dr. Tim Jennings. We are so glad that you're here, and thank you for sharing your time and your gifts with us.
Thank you for having me. And I am a graduate from Southern, and after I finished at Southern, I went to University of Tennessee and finished my bachelor's degree there, and then went to medical school at UT in Memphis, and then did my residency in psychiatry at Eisenhower Army Medical Center at Fort Gordon in Augusta, Georgia. And today, the topic that I was given to talk about was how to recover from sexual trauma, sexual abuse, how to handle and heal in the aftermath of being victimized in such a traumatic way. And obviously, it won't be possible to give you a comprehensive treatment plan on how to deal with sexual trauma and abuse recovery in 1 hour and a few minutes. So I'm going to try to give you an overview. But before I give you the overview, and before we talk about how to heal, it's important to talk about what we are trying to heal, what we're trying to resolve. In medical school, one of the first things they teach us is to diagnose, because if your diagnosis is wrong, then almost always your treatment is wrong. So we want to first discover what is the problem that occurs in sexual trauma, sexual abuse, that we're trying to heal. In this regard, it's important to recognize that not everything that is legally defined as sexual abuse is equally damaging. Somebody who has a problem with frauderism, does anybody know what frauderism is? It's one of the paraphilias, which is one of the sexual deviations. Yes?
That's when you're in a crowded, when the person that suffers from it is in a crowded area and will bump up or rub against somebody, and the person that they're rubbing against might not know that it wasn't an accident, and the person that did it is getting a sexual pleasure from it.
Well stated. That's exactly what frauderism is. Bumping into someone, typically into their backsides, but could be bumping into them, any portion of them, without the person knowing it and getting sexual gratification from it. Often, crowded subways, crowded places, crowded elevators where this type of sexual deviation occurs. Yes?
Sorry, I need to clear up that. I didn't quite follow. The person that is bumping into the person is the one getting the gratification?
Yes. Yes. So, frauderism. Bumping into somebody without their knowledge to get sexual gratification. Voyeurism. You know what voyeurism is? Voyeurism is observing someone without their consent for sexual gratifying purposes. And who knows? Everyone in the room may have been a victim of voyeurism. How do we know? Not all things that are defined as sexual abuse legally are equally damaging. You could even construct a case where a woman is raped. She goes in for her vaginal hysterectomy and is put under anesthesia, and the anesthesiologist and the gynecologist rape her and then do the vaginal hysterectomy, and she never finds out that she was raped. But then 10 years later, someone shows her a video camera from the surgical suite, and she sees what happened. Now the trauma begins. The psychological damage starts at that point. The point being is, the psychological damage, the mental damage, depends on how the experience is internalized, how it is understood, how it is experienced. A child who is being bounced on the lap of an adult who was being sexually gratified by that experience, that is legally sexual abuse. But if the child experiences that as daddy was playing horsey, the real trauma may come when the social worker and the legal justice system take that child and put him into therapy, put him under testimony, begin asking questions, begin telling the child that they were an abuse victim when the child had no knowledge that they had actually been victimized. Does that make sense to everyone? It's very important that you remember that, because when you find someone, when you find someone who has had something like this happen, it's very important to assess what they think of the experience, where they're coming from. Their understanding of what happened will give you better insight into help deal with the actual trauma. A person beaten with a whip while they're tied to the bedposts might be terribly abused or might be terribly gratified, depending on the way the person is interpreting the experience. Now let's talk about example, before we talk about it, this is also true on any type of exploitation. Let's say that you're at home, somebody breaks into your house, steals something, leaves, and what they stole was not noticed, and you never know someone broke into your house. Will you experience any trauma from that? But when you discover someone broke into your house and something was stolen from you, then there can be the experience of vulnerability, anxiety, victimization, and all those things. Awareness is necessary, and how it's interpreted is also important. So let's talk about the situations now in which it is clear-cut, unequivocal, abuse of some sort, where everyone involved knows it was abuse, molestation of someone in a very powerful position. What happens? What's the damage? What's the problem? What are we going to try and treat? Well, at birth, when we come into the world, we have hundreds of millions of neurons in our brain, more at birth than we do by the time we are 8, 10 years of age. During the first 8 to 10 years of age, your brain is busy killing neurons. Why would it do that? Well, the way I conceptualize this is, imagine Michelangelo's block of marble before Michelangelo begins working on his block of marble. And then he begins working on it. When he's finished, he has less marble, doesn't he? But he's got a masterpiece. Your brain comes into the world as a baby, prepared to be worked upon by the experiences of environment and training and learning. And the brain will keep the neurons that are being used and delete the neurons that are not being used. Imagine someone, and you've heard of the case of children who have been locked away with no language spoken to them for the first 8 to 10 years or 12 years of life. And then someone finally finds them in this horrible situation and begins to speak to them. Do they ever learn language correctly?
No,
because a critical period of time passed when the brain was not having these neurons that were ready to receive this language used, so the brain deleted them. Gone. Killed. Those neurons are not there to be used when someone starts speaking language again. Why is this important? Well, in the brain, I'm going to give you a little brain physiology because I want to tie this all together and how this works when somebody is abused. But little brain physiology. We have prefrontal cortex. This is the part of the brain where you do your thinking, your reasoning, your creativity, your self-restraint, your self-governance. Deeper in the brain, I've outlined some of these parts, but generally it's called the limbic system. The limbic system is that part of your brain where you get your aggression, your rage, your hostility, as well as your fear and anxiety. Let's say you're on your way home tonight and somebody cuts you off in the interstate and you get that aggressive urge to send them, you know, an unfriendly hand signal of some sort. Some of you have seen that. That is coming out of your limbic system. But if you remember, wait a minute, I'm a student at Southern Adventist University. I don't behave that way. And you restrain yourself. That's coming out of your prefrontal cortex. Now, think of disorders where there's an imbalance of limbic system and prefrontal cortex. Limbic system is still working like normal, but prefrontal cortex is impaired in some way. Classic example is attention deficit disorder. Attention deficit disorder is a disorder where they don't have enough chemical called dopamine in the prefrontal cortex. It's not working like it should, but the limbic system's still working. And core feature, if you know anything about attention deficit, is they have impulse control problems. They can't restrain themselves. They have difficulty holding themselves back. Their limbic system kicking up all these impulses, but they can't stop themselves. They can't. They blurt out answers. They say things they don't mean. They act out in different ways. Let's think of a different disorder entirely. Alzheimer's dementia. Alzheimer's dementia is loss of neurons to the prefrontal cortex. Limbic system is still working. And what happens with people dement? They lose the ability to restrain and govern themselves. They have the impulses of various kinds. They will say things that they've never said practically in their life. They will act out in sexual and other ways that they've never done because these impulses are there, but the prefrontal cortex to govern is not there. Different syndrome entirely. Alcohol intoxication. You intoxicate somebody with alcohol, you knock down prefrontal cortex. Limbic system is still working. And everybody knows when somebody gets intoxicated, they lose the ability to self-restrain. They get disinhibited. They act out in various ways, aggressively, sexually, and other ways. Television watching in children. Television watching in children. What happens with television watching in children? Television watching, we're talking theatrical television now. This is not you've gone to church and it was so full you had to sit in an overflow room and watch the preacher on the closed circuit TV. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about theatrical entertainment. What happens with theatrical entertainment? All theatrical entertainment is designed to activate your limbic system and turn off your prefrontal cortex. Think about it. Whether it's a comedy, it wants to get you to laugh. Whether it is a drama, it wants to get you to cry. Whether it's a suspense, it wants to get you scared. Or a action adventure where it wants to get you violent and kill him, kill him. Or whatever it might be, or an erotic movie, get you aroused. It's all designed to react in the limbic system to create an emotional reaction while it suspends the activity of the prefrontal cortex. Why is this important? Remember we just talked about the brain comes into the world with hundreds of millions of neurons more at birth than it does by the time the child is 8 to 10 years of age. And the brain deletes neurons that aren't being used, like we talked about the child who doesn't get language spoken to them. They watch hours and hours of television, which is activating limbic system and turning off prefrontal cortex. Guess what happens? Limbic system gets overactivated. Lots of limbic system neurons get retained. People tend to be emotional, impulsive, aggressive. And prefrontal cortex doesn't develop the very important circuits that they need. And there's increased risk of attention deficit disorder, violence, and acting out. Multiple studies have now shown that kids who watch lots of TV have increased violence over kids who don't, because they don't have the impulse restraint and governance. Also increased risk of attention deficit disorder. That's why the American Academy of Pediatrics and American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry recommend no television for the first several years of life and real strict limits thereafter. I recommend no television for at least 7 years of life. It's very damaging. At least this type of television, theatrical entertainment. Now, I tell you all this to lead you up to our discussion today and what we're talking about, childhood trauma and abuse. Given you so far, I think, four or five different ways where there's an imbalance between prefrontal cortex and limbic system. All of them have in common loss of impulse control, aggression, violence, acting out. I want you to imagine when you have your final exam, on the day of your exam, put yourself in this mindset. At any moment while you're sitting there taking your exam, somebody might come in and beat you or rape you. It could happen imminently at any moment. How well do you think you'd score on your exam?
Not very well.
No. And you have a prefrontal cortex that's developed. Now, think about a child who lives in a home where they're being abused, where they're being molested, where they're being beaten, where they're being mistreated, and they live in this environment where they're constantly afraid at any moment somebody can come in and beat them, molest them, rape them. Their prefrontal cortex is constantly being pummeled with all these stress hormones. They're not developing the neural circuits. At the same time, the limbic system is being overactivated. And so these kids grow up not only with software, in other words, the learning, object relations, their self-image, the way they see themselves all twisted and distorted, they grow up with distorted brains. Hardware is not right. That's why it's so difficult to treat these patients. I'm going to take you a few steps deeper. That's the general overlay of how this works. I'm going to take you a few steps deeper and let you see a little more clearly how this works. In the limbic system, there's some different elements of the limbic system. One of those elements in red that I've diagrammed here is called the amygdala. The reason I've diagrammed it in red is because I want you to imagine we're going to use the scenario of a fire department. The school, fire alarm, fire department, 911 operator, all those things. The amygdala is your fire alarm. You go over the wall and you pull the fire alarm, that's the amygdala. It's the fire alarm. Let me give you an example of how it's supposed to work. You're walking along Sabbath afternoon with a group of young people on the nature trail over here. And out of the corner of your eye, you see something black and slithery in the grass. The amygdala fires. The amygdala fires, and then it'll activate the hypothalamus pituitary axis, which kicks on the adrenal glands, pumps out all that adrenaline, and corticosteroids, glucose starts coming out of the liver to give you energy, starts diverting blood away from the intestines and the skin into the muscles so you can run really fast. The heart rate kicks up, the blood pressure kicks up, and you're ready to roll. Right? That's the amygdala, which is the alarm, which hits the 911 operator, which is your pituitary axis here, which kicks on the fire department, which is your adrenal glands, kicking up all those steroids to get everything rolling. And then, after all that happens, you notice it's just an old rubber hose. That's your prefrontal cortex, which takes a second to catch up to the alarm. And the prefrontal cortex sends the message down to the amygdala, it's just a rubber hose, and the alarm goes off. It stops firing. Is that making sense to everybody? Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Y'all experience that? Yeah. One other act. So we have the amygdala firing, turning on all this stuff to get you rolling. The prefrontal cortex comes in, assesses the situation, tells the amygdala it can calm down, doesn't need to keep firing. Now, once the amygdala fires, however, kicks up all this corticosteroids, this part of your brain, called the hippocampus, has receptors in it that measures the amount of glucocorticoids, the corticosteroids that your adrenal glands are releasing. And when it releases enough, it's like your fire chief on the scene says, okay, we got enough firemen here, you can stop sending out firemen, sends a message back over to the hypothalamus, sends a message back to the hypothalamus, tell the hypothalamus, okay, you can stop sending, we got plenty of corticosteroids, tell the fire department we're okay. So that's designed to calm things down as well. What gets interesting now is kids who've been abused. What happens in abuse situations? In abuse situations, this circuitry coming back to the prefrontal cortex is broken. And I'm going to go into the reasons why and how psychotherapy and how medicines work. But this circuit coming back here, the signal to calm the amygdala and turn off the alarm is broken for lots of reasons I'll get to. So the alarm keeps firing. Glucocorticoids are coming up telling the hippocampus here to turn off the hypothalamus. You think, okay, even though the alarm is firing, this should turn off the hypothalamus and stop things, right? Well, as long as the alarm keeps firing, it causes a group of terrorists to arrive on the scene called cytokines. Cytokines are inflammatory agents. And these terrorists kill the receptors and the neurons in your hippocampus. And so this ability to calm this system gets broken, too. Because you're not sending good thoughts down here, you're sending negative thoughts, destructive thoughts down here, keeps the alarm ringing, causes these cytokines to kick up, kills the hippocampus and the hippocampal neurons, so you can't calm your hypothalamic pituitary axis, you keep all these stress hormones going, and that's why kids who have had trauma have increased risk of heart disease, cancers, die at younger ages, inflammatory diseases, all these other things, because they keep the stress stuff going all the time. Now, the hippocampus is also the part of your brain that is essential for new learning. Right now, as you're listening to me, your hippocampus is active. New memories all go through the hippocampus. Every new piece of information you learn goes to the hippocampus first, and then if it becomes a long-term memory, it is transferred to other regions of the brain, but it has to go through the hippocampus first. Well, what do you think is going to happen to new learning to people who've got damaged hippocampus? They have trouble learning, too. Post-trauma victims have trouble learning. You all notice that? Yes, because their brain is damaged. Okay? Now, I'll pause and take questions. Am I going too fast for you guys? Is it making sense? Okay?
I'm going too fast to take notes, but it's making perfect sense.
Good. Good. Now, how do antidepressants work? Antidepressants come in, and they have the ability, through various receptors, I won't get into all the technical details, but they have the ability to calm directly the amygdala. Even though we're still sending bad thoughts down from here, it can calm the amygdala. So the intensity of the alarm being sent over to the hypothalamic pituitary axis is reduced. They also have the ability to turn on proteins called neurotrophic factors, just like fertilizer for your neurons, cause neurons to grow and become healthy in the brain, in the hippocampal regions. So they restore the sensitivity of the hippocampal regions to the ability to sense the corticosteroids, to send a calming signal, so it calms this whole cycle back down. And this is how antidepressants work generally in the brain, so they can calm this system for these patients. Yes?
What happens when the brain gets used to a certain antidepressant? Has to be switched to another one.
Well, I was about to get to that. It depends on the patient and depends on what we're treating. Antidepressants in abuse patients without psychotherapy almost always fail. What happens is you'll initially get this improvement because they come in and they calm the limbic system. They start kicking up neurotrophic factors here, which start helping the hippocampal regions improve. But if you don't do the therapy, which I'm going to get to in a moment, how that works, then what happens is you continue to send these negative signals down, firing the amygdala, firing the amygdala, firing the amygdala, and it overcomes the impact of the medicine to help calm the amygdala, and eventually the whole cascade of events just continue on. So you have to do psychotherapy as well to change the thought processing. Now we know, without getting into the specific examples yet, negative thoughts, guilt thoughts, worried thoughts, pessimistic thoughts, self-derogatory thoughts, fire the amygdala to fire and kick up that whole destructive cascade of events. Healthy thoughts, happy thoughts, peaceful thoughts, not blowing smoke thoughts that you don't believe, thoughts that you actually experience genuinely, calm the amygdala. Turn the circuit system off. A merry heart doeth good, like a medicine. It's true. Yes?
But how does negative thought compare to, you know, if you go back to your snake thing, because snake, you know, that was fear and it was, you know, you needed your adrenaline, whereas negative thoughts is more, you know, mood in a sense that, I guess just going back to the part of that, I'm not understanding how completely.
Yes, negative thoughts will fire the amygdala, even though it may not have the same intensity as panic. It fires it to fire in a lower level sense.
What is it trying to fight? You know, is it trying to fight negative thoughts, or what is it?
Oh, there's no specific object. It's that I'm not at peace. I'm not relaxed. There's something wrong. Okay, there's something wrong. Pay attention. Fix it.
Mm-hmm.
This happens also in wartime, post-traumatic stress victim. Imagine this scenario. You're in Iraq right now as an American. You're not a soldier. Let's not even put you as a soldier. You're just a volunteer in Iraq as an American, volunteering with some aid agency, walking the streets alone in Iraq. How would you feel? Would your level of arousal be up? Would your scanning radar be like this? Would you be listening for every sound or thing that might come? You're in your apartment and you hear bumps and knocks and branches or whatever hitting your place. Are you going to be sleeping well at night, or are you going to have trouble unwinding and sleeping? You see, what's happening in all this situation is the amygdala is aroused. It may not fire full blast like when you see the slithery thing or when somebody breaks in your door. But the amygdala is not relaxed at its full. It's up. It's tuned up, wired up, adjusted up. So it's firing, keeping you alert and vigilant. People who've been in these types of settings who come home have a hard time down-regulating the amygdala, and so they have the chronic PTSD symptoms, which are they will startle very easily, they have sleep difficulty, they have emotional distancing. And the reason they're emotionally distant, let me ask you, if you were that person in Iraq that we just described about, how well would you be able to unwind and have a romantic dinner in that situation? You couldn't. You couldn't focus. You couldn't get connected. You have to have a calm amygdala to actually connect with people. A heightened amygdala causes so much anxiety you can't connect. And so there's this emotional distancing. Relationships start fracturing. Okay? And all this negative cascade of events start occurring. That's why our war veterans have so many physical health problems, because they're kicking up their stress hormones all the time. And by the way, the cytokines I told you, little terrorists that attack into your hippocampal regions and attack the receptors there, the cytokines also attack the insulin receptors in your body and thus increases your risk for diabetes. That's why there's so much diabetes when so many people have so much stress, anxiety, and worry. And what's the Bible say about the last days? Men shall run to and fro, their hearts failing them for fear. Fear is the amygdala firing all the time. We're afraid. We're insecure. It goes right back to all the abuse and things we're having in childhood. Okay. Yes?
One question. Medication without psychotherapy in cases of abuse will fail, you said. Other way around, equally true?
No. No. Psychotherapy can work even without medication in many, many cases. Psychotherapy for post-abuse victims is almost always more important than medication. I say almost always, and I'm talking about like a childhood abuse. Wartime veterans, there is a difference. There really is such a terrible upregulation. And in fact, there's some studies that show now that if you can get somebody in the immediate aftermath of an acute traumatic situation, you were raped yesterday, immediate aftermath, put them on one of the beta blockers, beta blocker which blocks the ability of the amygdala to kick up all the stress hormones, will actually prevent some of the post-traumatic stress consequences down the road. Will protect, to a certain degree, the hippocampal neurons from being damaged in the acute setting. In the chronic setting, that's not true. Yes?
Don't you think, with our understanding as a Christian university, you know, we should try to reduce the stress of our students so that we don't have it? Actually, I was going to just say something that I thought was really cool. I remember freshman year, I was in Ms. Bonnie's psychology class, and she took all our blood pressures the day before the test, which were really high for just about everybody. And so she said, all right, I'm going to divide the test in half. And I just like, ooh. So, I mean.
That's exactly what was happening. But do you know something? You are here to learn how to modulate and handle stress, how to not be stressed, and how you're not stressed. See, it depends on how you experience the exam. I wasn't stressed with my exam. Exam day was the day to shine. And exam day was the day to show off. Exam day was the day to go in and show all the stuff you learned and get those 105 points on your exam.
Yes.
That was exam day, right?
They like students like you.
Wasn't that exam day? Yeah, exam day is not a day to be stressed if you prepared all along. Okay. But what happens is you don't prepare all along, and so why you find yourself stressed that day is of your own devising. You see, and this is a very powerful lesson about life, not just about exams. Every one of you have judgment. Every one of you have judgment, the ability to think, reason, and draw conclusions that are healthy. And you have a sense of duty, which is your conscience convicting you of sense of duty, judgment. You also have feelings of various kinds that tempt us. James, the first chapter, no one should say God tempts. God doesn't tempt anyone. We struggle and entice by our own evil feelings or desires. And you have a battle inside. You have the power of choice, by the way, the anterior cingulate cortex right up here. This is your will. Your will resides in your anterior cingulate cortex. The way this works, prefrontal cortex is your reason and conscience. This is where your judgment lies. You draw conclusions. It sends the signal over here to the cingulate gyrus, which is your will, your power of choice. You have to make a choice. What am I going to believe? What action am I going to take? What am I going to do? That will directly impact the amygdala. When you make choices, however, based on the limbic system pushing up on your cingulate cortex telling you, oh, I don't really feel like studying. Come on, all the guys and girls are going out to a movie tonight. Man, I got to go see this movie instead. And I'm going to blow off. It won't be that big deal. I can cram and learn, right? I'll just drink coffee. I'll take like big liters of coffee and I'll stay up all night and learn, okay? All this is bad for your brain, toxic for the brain. I don't even have time to go into what coffee and caffeine does to your brain. It's not good. Don't drink it. Okay? Yes.
Is it possible to test, say a depression, whether it's chemical or emotional?
See, we're talking about depression now, aren't we? I hadn't got to depression yet.
Okay.
All depression has a common final pathway, and I guess we'll go ahead and go right into that right now.
Can I back you up?
Yes.
A second about the beta blocker. You said it blocks the amygdala.
It blocks norepinephrine and stress hormones from damaging the hippocampal regions and other areas of the brain. It can actually protect those areas. Okay. So basically, the stress hormones that the amygdala would kick up, the beta blockers can block those in the acute setting. It means it's just happened within the first less than a week or so. In the chronic setting, though, it really doesn't seem to have that much benefit at all. In fact, it doesn't have benefit in the chronic. A child who was abused and they're now 19, they're coming to see me in my office, I wouldn't consider it. It's not going to help them. But if it's an acute setting, it can sometimes be helpful. Okay. So let's go back then and talk about how these things, the depression. She wanted to talk about the depression, so let me see if I can put that piece together for you. Final common pathway for depression seems to be loss of neurons in the hippocampal regions of the brain due to this stress factor that we've talked about, kicking up the cytokines, which kill them. Now, that can happen for lots of reasons. Trauma is only one of them. It can also happen from hypothyroidism. It can happen from nutritional factors, B vitamin deficiencies, folate deficiencies, vitamin C deficiencies can contribute to the loss of neurons in these pathways. The final common pathway seems to be that loss of neurons and the glial cells, if you've heard of glial cells. Glial cells are the supporting cells, the white matter in the brain that make the neurons healthy and work. Those cells also die in these regions of the brain. Now, when you give antidepressants to people, antidepressants turn on these neurotrophic factors. Neurotrophic factors are like fertilizer for your neurons. When they're turned on, your brain cells like it. They're healthy. They'll branch out. They'll connect. They'll make new connections. And your brain makes new neurons in the hippocampal region under the influence of these proteins. So you guys are young enough that nobody in here probably remembers being told that your brain doesn't make new neurons. I was old enough that I was, and I'm sure, at least one or two other people back there, that was told that all the neurons you've got, if you lose them, they're gone. But that's not true. We actually know now the brain makes new neurons. As an aside, what substrate does the brain use to make a new neuron? When it's time to make a new neuron, some cells divide by cell division. One cell divides into another cell, right? A neuron who may have up to 5,000 connections to other neurons, can it kind of disengage from all those connections and split and then re-engage all those connections? No, it can't do that. So what's it use? Bone marrow stem cells. Bone marrow stem cells, when they influence these proteins, will differentiate into new neurons. Now, why is that interesting? What happens if somebody has a bone marrow transplant? Whose bone marrow stem cells do they have? Yeah. So what happens if a woman gets a bone marrow transplant from a man? Well, they've actually done autopsies on people, and sure enough, in the brains, they've got neurons with XY chromosomes instead of XX chromosomes, or vice versa.
Interesting.
Isn't that cool?
So it could, in a sense, influence...
We don't know the influences that it has. We just don't know the impact that it has. But it's very interesting. We're wonderfully and fascinatingly made. Okay, so... Also, let me just say very quickly, brain-derived neurotrophic factors, one of those fertilizers, neurotrophic factors I was telling you about, it comes from a protein called pro-brain-derived neurotrophic factor, and there's an enzyme that cleaves it in half, turning it into brain-derived neurotrophic factor. Interestingly enough, pro-BDNF, before it's cleaved, you know what it does? It kills neurons. But if you cleave it with an enzyme, then it makes neurons grow and be healthy. Guess what decides whether the pro-BDNF gets cleaved so it becomes a fertilizer and makes neurons healthy, or whether it stays as pro-BDNF and kills the neuron. Guess what makes that decision? Whether the neurons are being used or not. If the neurons are being used, then the neurons get the BDNF and get healthy. If they're not being used, they get pro-BDNF and they get killed. Everything depends on the right action of the will. By the power of choice, you have the power to determine whether your neurons are going to get the neurotrophic factors to make them grow healthy, or whether they're going to get the pro-BDNF, which is going to kill them, by the failure to choose. So the actions you choose develop your neural network, which develops your character. So too with the experiences of childhood. A child in that environment we talked about earlier, where they're under this constant abuse and stress, which neurons are getting all the activity? The limbic system neurons are getting all the activity. The prefrontal cortex neurons are not working, not getting the activity they should get, and so they're not developing those important prefrontal cortex circuits. Neurons are dying in the prefrontal cortex, being deleted. Pro-BDNF is knocking them off. Limbic system is getting stronger and stronger and stronger. And now, does anybody know what an adult looks like who's been a victim of childhood sexual abuse, if it's been fairly difficult and severe, not like a one-time occasion? Yes?
My mother, which we've discussed in this class, was abused for 15 years. She's chronically disabled.
Did she have moodiness?
Oh, yes, she's bipolar.
Could she reason well?
She was a surgical nurse, charged for many years.
But you're talking IQ now.
Yeah, she reasoned, she was very functional, and then she got to a point where she could not function anymore.
Did she have good self-governance and self-control?
That's hard for me to say, because by the time that she began to fall apart, I was about 10.
You see, people typically have the limbic system give such impulses that they act on those impulses rather than working through those impulses through the prefrontal cortex, their reason and judgment, and making healthy decisions that are in their best interest. They tend to have relationship problems, broken relationship after broken relationship, not just necessarily love relationships, but family relationships, sibling relationships, peer relationships, school relationships, friend relationships, relationship problems all over the place because they have impulses. They get their feelings hurt when no hurt was intended because the limbic system is overactive all the time and everything's all self-referenced. They're not very rational or reasonable people, even though they have IQ. Some of them can be quite intelligent, quite brilliant, in fact. But yet they're not wise. They're not reasonable people. Because these cortex neurons in the prefrontal cortex haven't really developed to develop those circuits for wisdom, reason, and self-control. Okay, let's see if we can't bring this together now. So with all this in mind, what type of, you understand what's going on, they've got all this biologic stuff going on, they have modeling, have you talked about modeling in here? By beholding we become changed, okay, modeling. They've had what kind of relationships modeled to them in childhood if they're abused? Bad relationships, unhealthy relationships modeled to them. So they have bad modeling. What about their self-image? What kind of image do they learn about themselves in childhood? Distorted or healthy? The distorted self-image. So they got a distorted self-image. They've already got bad hardware. We've already seen that. That's still firing the amygdala. They got this stuff going on through childhood. But they've also got bad object relations, which are peer relations, bad self-image, bad self-psychology or self-belief system. So with all that in mind, what kind of therapies or interventions would be important to help somebody like this? Psychotherapies, yes. And you see, the pharmacotherapies have a place, but the pharmacotherapies aren't the most important thing to help people in this type of experience. They have a place, but typically they always fail without some other therapy involved to bring healing to the higher cortical centers of the brain. Yes?
And you said something earlier about the will and how it comes into play with this.
Yes.
What if you have all the therapies involved, you know, talk therapy and the mood stabilizers, the antidepressants, but the person doesn't want to get better?
Well, see, that... Yeah, the therapy is not effective if the person defeats it. The person has to want to get well. And what typically happens is, and I guess this is a great lead into that, my next note here was, one of the key things, the first things you have to help somebody do, if you're going to be somebody to help them, is not let the abuse define who they are. Not let the abuse define who they are. They are not what happened to them. What happened to them was an event that defines much more so the person who did it. From the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. From what's in us, we reveal by the behaviors. The behaviors we carry out show the kind of heart we contain, right? So the abuser reveals himself in his abuse, but the five-year-old child who's being abused, okay, when you go out in the parking lot here, you see a 40-year-old man cursing at a 5-year-old little girl, calling her every ugly word you've ever heard in your life, screaming at the top of his lungs, red in the face. Do you look at that and go, what a horrible 5-year-old little girl? What does his behavior tell you about the little girl? Nothing. It tells you something about him. But what does the little girl walk away feeling like? Like she's a rotten, good-for-nothing little girl. Is she right? Is her conclusion correct?
No, but that's all she knows.
Her conclusion is wrong. Do not let... You have to immediately start working with people in therapy to change what they think about themselves in regard to what happened to them. Many abuse victims fall into the trap of letting the abuse define their identity. Their identity is wrapped around the abuse. And that's why people won't give it up. Because if they give it up, who are they? They're nobody. They're special. A lot of them will wear their abuse on a sleeve like a badge of honor. They will come in and they will announce in settings of various kinds how they've been abused. They must make it known because that's who they are. And it immediately derives what? Sympathy, compassion, love. Oh, you poor dear, you poor thing. It is not about getting well. It's a twisted and unhealthy way derived from the experience of childhood and with all the stuff we've talked about of trying to find love that they never received in a healthy way because they've allowed themselves to identify this. I had a patient who was abused by her uncle, and she came to see me, and her problems were primarily anorectic problems. And she actually came to see me because her primary care physician sent her because she was so thin, she'd stopped having periods. And she was 5'9", 5'10", weighed about, I think, 100 pounds when she came to see me. She was fairly thin. And yeah, you think, he says. And we started working together. And see, she felt fat. She felt fat. Now, anybody ever work with anorectics? They always feel fat. But are they fat? Okay, the first thing I wanted to do is I want to get prefrontal cortex working, okay? If you think you're fat and you weigh 102 pounds and you're 5'10", is your prefrontal cortex working?
No.
No, it's not working. So I've got to get prefrontal cortex working, first thing. Got to get her thinking, got to get her reasoning. So I asked her if she had a friend who was 5'10 and weighed 105 pounds, would you think she was fat? Well, no. I said, objectively, now don't tell me how you feel. Just tell me, factually, based on the amount that you weigh, looking at the obesity scales, would you define yourself as obese? She was able to say, no, I'm not obese. But yet you still feel fat, don't you? Yes, I feel fat. What does that information tell us? Just that piece of information. We know that she...
What she's feeling is
Yes, what she's feeling is not true. So if it's not true, does that mean that, well, then if it's not true, I should just pretend it's not there?
No.
No. See, it's another little piece of insight you've learned. Feelings can lie. one feeling can masquerade as another feeling. If you went to a masquerade ball and you saw somebody with a George Bush mask, would you look over and go, "Oh, that must be George Bush"? Or would you go, "That looks like George Bush, but I know it's not him"? You see, this feeling of fatness comes up, and she goes, "I must be fat. I must be. I feel fat. I must be." Do people do this all the time? "I feel worthless. I must be worthless. I feel guilty. I must be guilty." People get feelings of all kinds, and they just accept it. Must be. Must be. No. You need to stop and say, "Wait a minute. What's the evidence say? What's the truth say?" Truth is, I'm thin, but I feel so fat. So something must be under there. So if you're at that masquerade ball and you want to see who's in the mask behind George Bush's likeness, what do you have to do? Go over and pick up the mask and look under, don't you? So you have to pick up that feeling of fatness. And when we started picking that up, I said, "Tell me about what it's like to feel fat." "Well, I feel gross. I feel ugly. I feel nasty." How did you feel when your uncle was molesting you? Ugly, gross, nasty. Now we're getting closer to the issue, aren't we? She had never dealt with the issues of what happened with her uncle. She felt ugly, gross, and nasty. She channeled those into the feeling of fatness. By not eating, she could make the feeling go away and cure herself. So she didn't eat. But did she get better? No, because she wasn't dealing with the truth. We had to engage reason and engage the prefrontal cortex. So we started dealing with that. Ask the question. Is it a gross, disgusting, and nasty thing and an ugly thing for an uncle to molest his 5-year-old little niece? Is it?
Yes.
Yes, it is. Does that mean the niece is gross, nasty, and ugly?
No.
You see, so I had to give her permission to feel those things. And I said, "It's okay to feel those things. It was a gross experience. It was a nasty experience. It was okay to feel that. But you're not that way." And then you have to give some analogies to help them see that. If you were walking in a cow pasture, anybody walk in a cow pasture? And slip and fall on a cow pie. And it got in your face and up your nose and in your mouth. Would that be gross? Would that be nasty and disgusting? Does that make you a gross, nasty, and disgusting human being? No. Gross, nasty, and disgusting things can happen to us, but that doesn't make us gross, nasty, and disgusting. And as she was able to process through that, she was able to find some peace with herself. She was cured. She's not on any medication at all. She's a lawyer now. She weighs 125 pounds. Doesn't need anything. Is no longer anorectic. She's well. She was able to come to terms. She was able to recognize. And we don't have time to go into whole therapy that she needed. They always have to come to forgiveness issues. They have lots of resentment, lots of anger, lots of hostility. And one of the most important things to help them come to forgiveness issues is recognize. And the reason why they don't forgive, most commonly, it's not always the reason, but most common, you want to look for this, because the person has not been caught by society, has not been punished by society, and so they feel like if they forgive, they get away with it. No one holds them accountable. And I'm not going to let them get away with it. I'm going to hold them accountable. And so they hold this anger and resentment and bitterness inside. You have to help them see the truth. The truth is, no one ever gets away with it. Mm-hmm. Ever. Why? Now, I ask this question, and I always get deer in the headlight look of the abuse victims when I ask this question, always at the proper time in the course of therapy, not the first time I meet them, because they would leave and never come see me again. But at the proper time in the course of therapy, I will ask them, who do you think got injured, damaged, hurt worse, you or your abuser, when he abused you? They always say they did. And then I say, if God took you to heaven and gave you two choices, choice number one, you get your life exactly as it is, not one change of any kind, you get to be just who you are today. Choice number two, you get to trade places with the abuser, and you get to live his life, and he gets yours. And you get to go around molesting little children. Who would you choose? 100% choose to be themselves. Why? I say, why? Because the light goes on and they recognize, whoa, something else, something different gets damaged in you when you abuse little kids, doesn't it? See, you can have your body damaged by an abuser. You can have your emotions and your heart and even some of your psyche, your psychology damaged, your brain damaged. But they can't damage your soul. Your conscience can remain clear. But if you do that to someone else, something much more important gets damaged. And when you recognize that, they can let go and say, that's right. While they hurt me, they damage something much more critical in themselves. No one ever gets away with it. There's always damage. Does that make sense? Okay? This is very freeing. This is, and when we talk these discussions, we're engaging this part of the brain. Now we're sending a signal down here, you see? Signal down to the amygdala. Okay, I don't have to stay angry. It's okay. It's a calming signal. Calm the amygdala. Calm it down. I don't have to stay on edge all the time. Had another patient who came to see me who was identified herself. She had all the classic characteristics: moodiness, impulsiveness, broken relationships, anger control problems, crying spells, depression, and she identified herself as bisexual. And she came to see me, and in the course of therapy, we dealt with the abuse issues, and she was molested by her dad, and all these types of things. And the therapy went along. She disclosed to me her life history, that she had sexual relations with dad. She had sexual relations with another close relative. When she went away to boarding high school, she and her female roommate had sexual relations. When she went to college, her female roommate and her had sexual relations. She got a guy friend. They had sexual relations. And basically, she disclosed that every person in her life that she ever came to care about as a human being, to have intimacy of heart with, she slept with. She said to me at one point in therapy, I've never had intimacy with someone that I haven't had sex with. And I said, what about us? And the light went on. See, there's nothing much more intimate than a genuine psychotherapy experience, because you bare your soul to your therapist. And the light went on to her, whoa, I've had intimacy here for 8-10 months, and we haven't had sex. It's possible. Wow. And as we continued on for a few more months of therapy, she came back and said, you know, Dr. Jennings, I'm not bisexual. I'm heterosexual. She never was bisexual. She had this confusion of how to relate because her daddy related to her sexually at a critical time in her life when she was learning what intimacy was about and how you love somebody. And she translated that in, well, when you love somebody, this is how you behave. You live this way. And so she came to love her roommate. And so, well, if I love you, then this is what we do. On some level. Questions about any of that? Yes.
What do you do with that person if, you know, what you said to her, yeah, we're intimate. What if she had taken that as a challenge instead of as like an idea?
They always almost do. I mean, because it's very frequent that patients will make sexual advances.
What do you
do? It's your job to say no. Hello? I mean, what you do is you interpret that and you let them know that you understand that the reason they're having the arousal and that attraction is related to the way they've always related in the past, and that's not unusual. You interpret that in the it's often called transference, counter-transference stuff. Where it becomes dangerous is when the therapist has those sexual aroused feelings towards the patient. And that happens, okay? And it's almost always that the therapist is sexually aroused with a patient who has been sexually abused as a child. Almost always the case. Because the post-abuse victim, now there's different ways to respond to abuse, but out of that cohort of people, there's a cadre of people who tend to be very provocative and erotic in their way of reacting and dealing with people. And those type who get into therapy have the ability to project onto the other person positive regard, unmitigated with any qualifiers at all. This is called an internal split. They're split in their internal world, either into good and all good and all bad. Have you ever heard of splitting?
Yeah.
Yeah, splitting. See, most of you, if you deal with people, you experience them as good and bad. They have good qualities, they have bad qualities. This I like, that I don't. You experience yourself as having positives and negatives. People who are abused in childhood, we talked about the biologic damage. Psychologically, what happens is they have a failed integration of the self, where at the time when you begin to realize that there are good things about yourself and bad things to come into a whole, that whole process is broken down. And so you split yourself internally, your emotional world, into good and bad camps. And then you deal with people from one of those two poles. And people in your world, there will be the people who are just on the... They are God's gift to life. I mean, they are just incredible. The most awesome human beings you've ever met. They are just on top of the world. Nothing. There's nothing negative about them. And if somebody says anything negative, you attack them. Don't you dare say it. That person's nearly Jesus Christ walking on water. And then everybody else, anybody who's not in that camp, is the devil incarnate. The difficulty in dealing with people like that is if you're in the positive camp, if you're dealing with a person who's got you in that positive camp, is intoxicating because you're being worshipped. And they see you, and it can. And this is what happens in therapy. The difficulty, of course, and not just in therapy, you will have people in your own lives, you will come in contact with some of them, and it doesn't have to be sexual, but often it is, where they deal with you in this way. The difficulty is you can never stay in the positive camp. It's just a matter of time before you say or do something that deviates from their internal little cookie-cutter mold that you must stay within. And as soon as you deviate without, I can't believe I was so wrong about you. You're just like all the others. And then you become the devil incarnate and they're out to destroy you. It's kind of the fatal attraction thing.
And that's typical sexually
restricted? That's typical dynamic that can occur in the post-sexual abuse child, yes, who grows into an adult. It doesn't have to always involve sexual abuse, but it frequently does. And not all people who are sexually abused develop with that particular dynamic, but it frequently does.
Emotionally abused,
physical abuse, yeah. Yeah.
I think it's also important just to point out that just because that sort of attraction might be developing doesn't necessarily mean the person was... I mean, I think it can happen in other circumstances, and I think with women, they want someone to listen to them, and if a man is willing to sit down for an hour and just listen, that's very attractive. And so I think it's important for male therapists or pastors or what have you to understand that that's a I don't want to need for everyone, but I think women especially, that sometimes it's a fill, then just be sensitive.
No, I think that's a great point. That's a great point. When they come out of this childhood with which they've been traumatized, there is this definite hunger for nurturance, for affection, for tenderness, for care, for regard, for love. Melanie Klein would say for the breast. Melanie Klein was a psychotherapist, and the breast is metaphorical of nurture, care, love. Okay, there's this desire and hunger for that nurturance that they didn't get. And so if someone does show them that tenderness, then they can be very attracted to that in a sexually aroused way. You're exactly right. And that's often why there's a heightened level of bisexuality and lesbianism amongst people who have had this type of abuse, because women tend to be more gentle, more caring, more loving than men, and also also don't necessarily bring back the traumas. Now, I don't want you to think that I'm saying that all sexual identity issues are related to trauma. They're not. But many of them who have had traumas like this struggle with sexual identity issues. So we need to be clear about that as well. Okay. So what kind of things can you say to someone who is struggling? What kind of things... Put yourself in the imaginary situation. Your patient, another story. What's the problem with somebody who's molested by their priest? Now, you know in the news that's happened commonly. I've had patients that's happened too. And if they're in a particular religious organization, the priest represents who?
God himself.
Exactly. Yes, I had a patient who was molested by a priest in Scotland, very conservative Catholic. And after each each act of molestation, he would tell her of her wickedness and her need to repent and confess, lest she burn in the fires of hell.
She's thinking the same castration for him. I said that would work good.
Lest he burn in the fire. Well, she was quite troubled. She was one of the first patients I saw as a resident, and I mention her in my book. Anyway, I was troubled because I didn't have a whole lot to help her with in my second year of residency. What would you say to her? What would you imagine one of her problems would be in that dynamic? In addition to everything else we said, there's something we haven't mentioned. Yes?
You know, one of the things that I come across and what would pop into my mind as a Christian counselor is you don't want to start out with God love, because to her, that is just, God's love is not good love.
That's an excellent point. She didn't trust God. She was angry at God. God did this to her. God was the source of her pain and misery. He screwed her life over. I mean, that was God that did this. What do you think she would be able to do in, as far as someone saying to her, trust me?
No way.
She had major, major problems with trust, major problems with God, and those issues would definitely want to be taken up by the therapist to deal with. Validate her, some of the things we've already talked about, that what happened to her was not a representation of her, it was a representation of the priest. You know, that's a selection bias, by the way. You know what a selection bias is? Can anybody explain a selection bias? A selection bias is when you're selecting a population of people and there's some filtering mechanism that doesn't allow just the general population to approach. It filters the population in such a way that only certain types of people can get into that group. That's a selection bias. Does that make sense? Now, what kind of people do you think end up in a priesthood where you have to be celibate? It's a selection bias. People who are struggling with sexual issues and want divine help not to act on them are biased into that profession. There'd be a much less problem in that particular organization if they allowed their priest to marry. Not saying it would erase it, it wouldn't. But it would reduce it because the bias would be reduced. Yes?
Why don't they believe in the Bible verse that says it's not good for man to be alone?
I'm not going to be an apologist for the Catholic Church at this point. You can take that up with them, but yeah.
Because it's in the Bible, and I was just like, why would you make something so central in your church if you're trying to follow the Bible?
Because they take Paul's writings that you should be committed totally to the mission of the church and not distract yourself with a woman.
And they take, you know, some of the, you know, back in the day, Augustine and all those people that say the body is bad.
Okay, we need to wind up. I've got how many minutes do I have left? 15 minutes left. Okay, we have 15 minutes left. Okay. So let me wind up with some more examples. All these kids come into adulthood with a distorted self-image. Little analogies that you can do to help them and see what they kind of do with things. They doubt themselves. They have fear. They're insecure. They have many, many negative self-thoughts. So think about the dynamic we talked about earlier. Persons who have been abused, they think that they're not as worthy as other people. They think they're not as valuable as other people. They think they're gross. They think they're ugly. They think they don't have confidence in themselves. This is constantly firing down the amygdala that they're afraid of rejection. They're afraid of abandonment. They're afraid of what others are going to think of them. They're afraid if anybody should ever find out what's happened to them. So they live in fear constantly, constantly pinging the amygdala. So they struggle with this mood stuff. They're desperate and craving for attention and affection. They want approval. They want people to like them. They work really hard to try to get people to like them, but they're terrified that people will come to find them for who they really are because they live behind a mask. They don't live genuinely and openly. So an analogy you can think about, imagine a young couple gets married. They're very poor, and this young couple has no mirror in their house, so they go to a yard sale, and they find a full-length mirror for 50 cents. And the reason it's 50 cents is because the bottom third is warped and it gets this kind of warped, distorted image. But, you know, they don't care about that bottom third. 50 cents, they buy it, put it on the back of their bedroom door. A couple years go by and they have their first child. Their first child begins to toddle around and walk and looks into the mirror and sees themselves. and then goes out on the playground and sees all the other kids. What image do they see of themselves when they look in the mirror?
They're different than
them. A distorted and warped and ugly image. And they look in the mirror and say, oh, I'm gross, I'm ugly, I'm nasty. And they go out on the playground and say, I'm pretty. So they get their crayons out and they get their paper bag out and they begin drawing as best they can this little face that they put on whenever they go out, this paper bag over their head. And as they get older, they get better and better with cosmetics and other things that they can get better and better and approximate what everybody else looks like and the way they present themselves to the public. And they live behind this mask that they think that everyone else sees and looks like. Imagine how that person would be. They've gotten pretty good with the mask. They look pretty much like everybody else now. And some people come up and start to be friendly with them and talk to them. And, hey, you're neat. Why don't you come over to my house? The closer those relationships get, what's going to happen to their emotions?
Increased vigilance.
Yes, increased vigilance and fear, lest they find out I'm wearing a mask and look under and see how truly gross and nasty I am. And that's why the relationships are so difficult, because they so much want to be loved and they want to get close. But as they do start to get close, the fear level goes up, so they push back. They do something to distance the relationship. Push back. And the relationships are like yo-yos. You get close to a point, push back. Get close to a point, push back. They don't want anybody to ever see under the mask. I use this analogy with my patients, and I help them see that the image that they've seen of themselves all these years is the distorted one. Now, wait. And I say, let's take the analogy of the real physical appearance for a moment, not the internal self-image, but the real physical appearance. They're wearing a mask. And now, for the first time, they take off the mask and they look at themselves in a real, genuine, healthy mirror. Will they recognize themselves? No. And recognize this. This is important. People who do come to see them who they really are and say something like, "You're one of the neatest people I've ever met. You're awesome. You're beautiful. You're so smart. You're this. You're that." What they do is they go, "That's not me. I don't know who they're talking about. That's not me." Because they don't recognize themselves. That's not them. That's somebody else. And all the positive things are discounted. Well, any negative thing that comes along is, "Yep, that's me. That's who I am." And they hold on to it. Distorted internal image learned in their earliest childhood. Now, in order for them to actually come to see themselves as that person they really are, wouldn't they have to spend a lot of time in front of that mirror going like this, making faces and touching their nose and doing all that stuff? Wouldn't they do that? If you had been in an accident and had plastic surgery, wouldn't you spend a lot of time in front of a mirror kind of checking out who you are to get that new image in your mind? Sure you would. They have to do that. What is the mirror? The mirror of childhood, what is it?
Parents.
Parents are the mirror of childhood. What is the mirror of an adult can look into to fix the distorted image that they had from childhood?
Friends, spouse, those friends, family.
Partially friends and spouse, but ultimately no. Partially, they can be beneficial, they can be helpful if they're healthy, but ultimately no. The truth itself. The truth itself is the mirror that we look into. Now, friends and family and therapists can help us see the truth, but it's the truth itself that must set us free. You'll know the truth, and the truth will set you free. It heals, it restores, it regenerates.
But how do they see that truth?
Yes, that's where friends and family can come in, or a therapist can come in. They can help a person see the truth. But ultimately, the person has to see the truth, recognize the truth, and believe the truth for themselves. Somebody else telling you the truth does you no good. It will just be discounted. Oh, it's not me. You don't know me. It's not who I am. If you knew who I was, you would never say that. Yes, you had a question.
Yes, this distorted image, does this come only from abuse, or can it, sexual abuse?
Oh, no.
Can it come from just...
Oh, yeah, any type, yeah. Absolutely. It can come from any type of a childhood relationship. A father who just shows disappointment in a child. You just disappoint me. All the time disappointed. Doesn't beat them, doesn't molest them, but just negative feedback constantly. The child will internalize, "Well, there's something wrong with me." And they will internalize this image, this construct of being a disappointment. So yeah, it can be any feedback. It can also be in a positive regard. Some kids can grow up narcissists because they were over-worshipped by their parents. So it can be a positive distortion. Those never look into the mirror. I mean, the mirror will only bring them down, okay? Yes. And another thing I often have people do in therapy is I teach them the reality as we begin to look at the past, we cannot change. We cannot change the historical facts of what has happened to them. History cannot be changed. But we can change how they experience history, how they recall it, how they react to the memories of history. That can change. And what an analogy I use is I help them use a filing cabinet analogy. Filing cabinet being the memories they have are filed in their brain, the events. And you open the filing cabinet, you pull out a particular file, that's a fact, an event. My sixth birthday, Dad molested me on my sixth birthday. If that happened, it happened. We can't change the fact that happened, can we? But then you say, where did you file that fact in your mind? Oh, that got filed under the fact that I'm gross, I'm nasty, I'm ugly, and I'm no good. Well, wait a second. Now, if you're an adult, you can reopen that memory, you can reopen that file, and you can ask a question. That happened, it was a gross, nasty, and disgusting experience, but now with my adult mind, let me look at that and think about that. If I saw today an adult man molesting his six-year-old child on her birthday, would I think that that child was a gross, nasty child?
The adult man is a gross, nasty child.
Did I file that in the right place? Mm-hmm. No, Dad was the one. Whoa. And you can't change the event, you can't change what happened, but you can change how that event was filed, how it was internalized. And then you change the meaning and the impact it has on the individual. And that's what psychotherapy is about. We're trying to change these internal constructs that reside up in this part of the brain so that we can calm the limbic system. Because if we keep those distortions up here, then we continue to fire down all these insecure signals, these fear signals that fire this up, kick that whole cascade of events going, keep all those negative hormones going, and keep us sick, disabled all the time. And then the other aspect, yes?
Can you do any form of therapy with a younger child, like more recently after something happened? Because, you know, their prefrontal cortex isn't developed, reasoning and logic.
Yes, yes. So the cognitive therapies would not be as robust in that, but that doesn't mean the therapies aren't important. They do have therapies for children. I'm not a child and adolescent psychiatrist, but yes, the question that you always have to ask yourself is, will the therapy do more harm than good? And that's a critical question, because I've had cases where a young child, dad, was arrested because he was taking a bath with his young daughter. Daughter was 18 months. Dad was gratifying himself by bouncing daughter up and down, you know, not vaginal penetration or any vaginal touching, but they were in the tub together and he was gratifying himself, bouncing the girl up and down. He got arrested for that. She's 18 months of age. If they never do anything else to that child and leave her alone, what's the damage that's probably occurred to her? Not much. Leave her alone. Put her in therapy for a few years, 5, 6, 7 years, get her into a therapist, you've ruined her. Ruined her. She will grow up knowing all this terrible things. And she will internalize an identity. I'm an abuse victim. I can't believe all this happened to me. It will ruin her. And many well-meaning, quote-unquote, therapists. By the way, you know, how do you spell therapist?
The rapist.
Therapist. It's very important that if somebody goes into therapy, that they get somebody who is competent and aren't dealing with their own issues in therapy. Because therapists can do a whole lot of damage if they're not in a fairly well-balanced position themselves. And I've had the experience, and I was the chief of psychiatry at Wayne Army Community Hospital. I led the mental health team that governed and provided health care for 40,000 lives. And we had a post-abuse team that would meet on a regular basis to assess allegations of various types of abuse, spousal abuse, childhood abuse, sexual abuse of all kinds. And we had to make determinations based on the allegations that were made. And I have seen where therapists let their histories get in the way of good judgment and attempt to promote conclusions that aren't borne by the facts because of their own histories. And so you'd want, yes, if there was clear-cut evidence that the child had been damaged and injured by those experiences, you'd want that child to get into some therapy to process through what's happened to them. But you wouldn't want to put them in such a treatment that would actually cause more damage than they've already experienced. Yes?
I'm a theology major, and I'm going to be working at a church, and I know that...
We love you anyway, man.
Counseling and everything. I've referred the person to a therapist. What's some ways for me to find out if it's a good therapist or not? Is there some resources or just by asking people with connections? I mean...
Yeah, people call me all the time and ask me...
Are you good?
No. They don't call me that. They call and ask, I'm in Florida, I'm in California, I'm in wherever. Can you tell me a therapist I can go to? No. I don't know anybody. I'd have to know them personally. I'd actually have to meet them, talk to them, experience their reasoning and the way they process, their philosophy. Just because the basic things you do is you look at credentials, you look at experience, mm-hmm. but the most important thing is to talk to people who have actually had that person as a therapist.
Okay.
See what type of treatment and rationale and things they recommend. If they have a book, read their book.
And having worked in a psychiatric hospital and still working there, check with the psychiatric hospital. They have a good list of people they refer to on a regular basis.
Yeah, but not all those people are good. I'll just tell you straight up from experience. Just because they're credentialed and because they have certifications and because they're licensed doesn't mean they're good and won't actually do harm.
But we also know the ones that are really, really bad.
They know most.
You've got some idea as to who you would refer to, or who I wouldn't send my family to.
Depends on the philosophy of the organization.
Oh, that's true, too.
Depends on the philosophy.
If me versus who you ask my co-worker might be different, but we all kind of have the same
view. Yeah. Okay, in closing then, I was going to mention the conditioned response. Also the other aspect, a lot of times people who've been abused as children get in marriages and have sexual relation difficulties in marriage. And they'll often come because they are not comfortable with sex with their spouse because of traumas of the past. And much of this is a conditioned response. Remember Pavlov's dogs? Every time you ring the bell, they salivate.
Yep.
Well, every time now a husband comes to approach, they're bringing back and regurgitating all these memories and experiences, and they get the emotional response. Instead of love, arousal, and openness, they get kind of feeling scared, frigidness, fear, and wanting to run every time this happens. These have to be worked through in therapy, too. You have to help them understand that this is a conditioned response to a great degree, and regurgitating some of the memories of childhood.
People that have been abused are sometimes
promiscuous. Okay, well, see...
It's okay.
People who have been abused are promiscuous, similar to what I already said earlier. They are looking... Sometimes they're wanting to control the thing that controlled them. By taking control of sex, they will sexualize and they will... master or manipulate the opposite sex or sometimes the same sex by using sex as a weapon that they'll never be taken advantage of again, because they're going to take advantage of everybody else on some level. That's one aspect of it. And the other aspect is wanting to, the intimacy aspect that I mentioned earlier, where anytime you're intimate, you're sexual. So two aspects of that. That answer the question you're concerned with?
Are really angry about their abuse, but at the same time, kind of throughout the sexual
life. It is very confusing, and you want to stay away, as far away from those type of young people in personal relationships, because what will happen is they're so confused themselves, they don't really know what they want, and they may send the signals of sexual interest. You get involved, and then you get alleged for having taken advantage. I mean, it can happen all the time, and it does happen. Because they misperceive that. Remember, prefrontal cortex has been damaged. So their ability to reason and judge and self-restrain is altered. And they perceive actual events differently. Let me just a quick example. Sometimes people say, he's bending the truth or he's twisting the truth. You ever heard that? Truth cannot be bent or twisted. You can only bend your mind around the truth. Mm-hmm. So imagine you have a telephone pole. It's straight. I hold a lens up between you and the pole. So now when you look at the pole looks bent. Have we bent the pole? The pole's still straight.
Your perception of the pole.
but your perception of the pole has been changed. Now, people who have distorted realities, they're lying to themselves because they're wearing that mask, because of the distorted image of self. They're not being truthful. Their minds are warped to a certain degree. They will see the pole differently than you'll see the pole. Now, if somebody's looking at that pole through a lens, but they don't know they're looking through a lens, they're unaware that they're looking through a lens, and you're looking at it the way it is, will you ever convince them the pole is straight? By logical argument? No. You have to get the lens removed first. Okay? This is the difficulty with people who've come out of things like this. Oftentimes, their perceptions of reality are different than what they really are. They misperceive interpersonal interactions. They see compliment when none was given. They see insult when none was given. They misperceive the subtleties, oftentimes, because of the warp in their own mind that needs healing. And so in closing, remember the principles that bring healing, truth and love. Genuine love is not sexual love. It's genuine compassion, care, regard for the other person. Truth, which activates these higher cortical faculties and strengthen those, and healing can come over time. Now, ultimately, if the patients are spiritual, a healthy spirituality can be helpful and is helpful, but oftentimes it takes a while to get people there because they've had so much broken trust and distorted. You'd be surprised at how many times the abusers are very religious people. Deacons, elders, pastors, priests, rigidly so, abusively so. And so their images of God are very, very distorted. So, questions in closing? Any questions?
Title of your book?
The title of my book, actually, I've got a copy here. It's Could It Be This Simple? Could It Be This Simple? A Biblical Model for Healing the Mind. It's available at the ABC. It just came out. The ABC got theirs last week.
Can you use a synopsis of it?
Yeah, it is a comprehensive overview written for lay people, so it's not written for on real technical language. We got more technical here than as far as language goes. It's a comprehensive book on how the mind was designed to work, what happened that destabilized the function of the mind after sin entered, God's plan to heal and restore, seven myths of forgiveness, appropriate and inappropriate guilt, how the law of love and liberty apply to healing the mind. I mean, it's got a lot of stuff in it. The bookstore sells it for $15.99. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.